This is a Media Lab podcast. Welcome to Putting It Together, the podcast that goes through the entire body of work of Stephen Sondheim, show by show and song by song. My name is Kyle Marshall, your self-described Sondheim expert, and I need to start the show this way. I mean, if you've been partaking in any of the news that's been going on around the world, but especially in the United States, if you've missed it, I guess congratulations to you for living under a rock. It must be really nice and cool underneath there, but it feels, to me at least, a scary, scary time. The killing of George Floyd has sparked this movement that has spread across the United States and into Canada, into Europe, pretty much everywhere in the world, to stand up against police brutality and the intrinsic white supremacy that is permeated in Western culture and in so many other countries around the world. And to not talk about what's going on feels like its own style of support for, in my opinion, the wrong side of this issue. Now, of course, this is a Stephen Sondheim podcast, but I do think that there is a relevance to talking about the issues of class and race within the context of musical theater. First, it's a bit wild to me that Stephen Sondheim wrote this lyric for the movie version of West Side Story almost 60 years ago. He had the character of Anita fire back at her boyfriend Bernardo by singing the following: "Life can be bright in America if you can fight in America. Life is all right in America if you're all white in America." That sentiment within the song America is one that I've been thinking of a lot the last couple of days. These characters who are moving to a better place are living in the society that is promoted as the epitome of Western ideology, that you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that all you have to do is have good ideas, that you'll be supported, and that you can make your living here. And yet so often, we are confronted with the reality that there are these roadblocks that are put into place. Not that you can't still rise above those, but boy, does it make it hard to drive down the road when you constantly have to hit the brakes. Now, of course, I'm speaking also from an intense amount of privilege. I do live in Canada where there are some differences, although we also struggle with our own form of colonialism and racism in our society. But also, I was raised middle class. I'm white. There's all these things that are given to me. And so at the beginning of our episode today, I just want to give a highlight of some of the performances that have appeared in Sondheim shows from Black artists. And I also do realize that theater in general should be doing a better job at highlighting Black voices, Black creators, directors, writers, songwriters, lyricists, actors and actresses. But because we have just finished our company season, I think we need to start off by really highlighting the fact that Adrian Lester portrayed Bobby in the Paper Mill Playhouse version of Company. And I think I talked about this with Eric Matthew Richardson in the episode that he was on, that while I don't think that Adrian Lester may be the best singer, boy, does he give one of the best Bobby performances, especially when you get into Being Alive, where that raw emotion is laid bare.
But alone is alone, not alone. Somebody crowd me with love. Somebody force me to care.
You also have the great Audra McDonald, who is, has the most Tony Awards of any living actress, but took on the role of Nurse Apple, Nurse Faye Apple, in Anyone Can Whistle, in a production that happened a few years ago. A character who does need to eventually realize that she can't just wait for a hero to arrive, but instead has to be the hero herself.
Just as long as he comes, alone.
another day.
And lastly, because of a podcast I actually listened to here a few months ago, I have become increasingly obsessed with Vanessa Williams. I think she is not just a good actress and a great singer, but her whole entire life story is beyond fascinating. Regardless, the revival of Into the Woods, where she portrayed the witch, is one of my favorite musical theater performances.
Careful the things you do, children will see and learn. Children may not obey, but children will listen. Children will look to you for which way to turn, to learn what to be. Careful before you say, listen to me. Children will listen.
What a time for that message to be prevalent, that no one, no one is alone. Well, we still do have a show today. I have a guest on, Hugh Summers. He's a new guest. He's a theater producer over in London, and I had a great conversation with him about Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. So I want to get to that as soon as possible. So before we do that, let's get to Plodding Along. Plotting Along is the part of the show where I describe to you what's happening in the plot. So our four principal actors have actually met up with one another, and they reminisce about how they first met. That's all we really need to know about the setup of this song here this week. Let's go thank some sponsors, and then when I return, it'll be my conversation with Hugh Summers about Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. Putting It Together is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. The Alberta Podcast Network promotes and supports Alberta-made podcasts and connects their audiences with Alberta-based businesses and organizations. This episode of Putting It Together is brought to you by Storylines, a podcast from Women in Film and Television Alberta. Storylines highlights some of our province's most successful women in film and television, both behind the camera and in front of it. Host Sheena Rossiter is herself a filmmaker, and she has had some deep and instructive conversations with trailblazers and experts in the field. A recent episode that you might find interesting is her conversation with Tasha Hubbard, an award-winning Cree filmmaker who speaks with her about how she got into documentary film, the importance of telling Indigenous stories, and the success of her most recent film, We Will Stand Up. Find Storylines on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find it at wifta.ca. That's wifta.ca. This week, Putting It Together is also brought to you by Pod Power. With Pod Power, ATB is making it possible for us to amplify the voices of Albertans and Alberta podcasters. This episode, we're giving a Pod Power shout out to What's the Cheesemus, a new podcast with an inside look at Filipinx identity and diaspora. Cheesemus is the Tagalog word for gossip. Subscribe to hear weekly episodes about disappointing your parents, breaking it to your friends that you're not Italian, trying to figure out why you punched a car, and much, much more. What's the Cheesemus is produced by CJSR, Edmonton's campus and community radio station. Download it wherever you find podcasts. I'm going to spell it for you because it's at whatsthecheesemus.transistor.fm. Cheesemus is spelled T-S-I-S-M-I-S. T-S-I-S-M-I-S. whatsthecheesemus.transistor.fm.
Hugh, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Happy to be here.
You are a new guest to the show, so I would love it if you started by describing who you are and what it is that you do.
My name is Hugh. I work as a theatre producer in London. I'm very new to the game. Only the past year or so I've started doing it. But my full-time normal job is the production assistant of The Boulevard in Soho, just off Shaftesbury Avenue, which is really interesting because it's the theatre which is next door to the one that the company revival was originally in.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I walk past that each day. That's my full-time job. But I also have my own small company and a couple of other little things that I do with theatres around London. And yeah, very new to the game, but very much into theatre. That's my life.
Your small company that you have, what kind of productions are you most interested in?
Well, so originally, it's not happening anymore, sadly, because it parted ways, but we were developing a musical, which was really interesting, but it turns out it had a different life in a different area. But we're looking to produce an opera soon, in the next year, a site-specific opera, potentially in a castle. So very rogue, but it's interesting. I love the idea of putting on interesting shows in interesting places. And that obviously ties quite well to what we're talking about in a ruined theatre. Wouldn't that be magical?
Yes.
But that's, it's for me, my life and how I got into theatre was very much the music side. I didn't study theatre or go to drama school or anything like that, but I always did music. And I remember when I was younger, I saw the original revival of Sweeney Todd in London, or one of the more recent ones that had Imelda Staunton, who plays Sally in the National Theatre one. And that sort of birthed my interest in theatre, realistically. And it was and from that point on, I've bonded and chatted with people over Sondheim ever since. And it really finds a way into, even if I'm not doing a musical, you know, Sondheim, there's always someone to connect with.
Was that before or after she was in the Harry Potter films?
Do you know what? I think it was after, because it was probably around 2009 or 2010, that production. And she made the big transition towards musical theatre at that point, and she's done a lot more since. Mm-hmm.
I know I've already mentioned this, although the episode will air after this episode because time is weird. But it's Imelda Staunton is this actress who I greatly admire and appreciate, and I think she does a great job. And unfortunately for her, because of her role in those Harry Potter films, I always think she's evil, no matter what. Yeah. She comes on stage like, "No, there's something you're hiding. I'm sure there's something to you."
I know exactly what you mean. And I'm not going to lie, it worked very well for Mrs. Lovett.
Yes, no, for sure. What was your first introduction to Sondheim then?
Well, so I suppose I would have heard things before. I would have seen West Side and all these things before that without really connecting the dots. But it was when my friend offered me this ticket to go and see this production of Sweeney Todd. It was when it was doing its run at a regional theatre called Chichester Festival Theatre. And I saw that. And then my school, weirdly, a few months later, took us to go and see the West End Transfer as well. So I saw that production twice, and I was just absolutely obsessed with Sweeney Todd. And for a long time, that was all I listened to with musical theatre.
Yeah, yeah.
And I worry sometimes I sound like a bit of a snob when all I talk about is Sondheim with musical theatre, because when that was my introduction, I just thought everything afterwards, not as clever, not as good.
Get this out of my face. Yeah. What do you think was so you were so taken with, though? Like, you talk about yourself being a bit of a snob, but why was Sondheim the thing that like lit your head on fire?
I think it was in part with this thing that we always hear when we see interviews and people talking about Sondheim, is this idea of a narrative and the depth of character. And I think even when you don't, I didn't know anything really academic or analytical about theatre, I still got that impression that there was a lot of depth to these shows, and it doesn't feel like what people traditionally, even now, I think, consider musical theatre in a lot of senses. But also just how musically and lyrically, how clever it is. I think if you were a music student, as I was at the time, and you're being given these shows and you're analysing them, the more and more you look into how he does certain things, you go, "Oh God, clever."
Yeah.
And it's the little things that just make it just so clever, and it's impressive, but it makes it more enjoyable on each subsequent listen as well, I think.
When did you get into Follies?
Well, Follies was definitely a much later one for me. I don't know why. I think it was just coincidental. I think the path originally was sort of, it was Sweeney and then Company and then Sunday and all the other one. And Follies only really came into my life in more recent years. I think maybe that was because it's sort of, I didn't realize originally that it was a Sondheim show, because whenever I've been played it, because of this nature of it sort of being written as a pastiche and a tribute to all these other composers, it's not quite as Sondheim-y in its sound, if you know what I mean. I mean, if you delve into it, like, I think all the elements are there, but it's well disguised beneath all the like Cole Porters and Irving Berlins and stuff. It's great.
That's the recurring theme that I've had with talking with people for this season, is that you definitely have, if you dig into it, oh, there's some Sondheiminess going on here. But especially when those pastiche songs come in, it's a it's really next level because you have Sondheim lyrics, of course, is written by him, but he's emulating sometimes one certain composer for lyrics and a different composer for music. And then that's like this whole other like third level of like, how is this all working together? This is why it sounds different than everything else.
God, and I didn't realize. Like,
yeah, honestly, there is like, he's playing like 3D chess when everyone else is playing checkers. And it's just like so weird.
It's like a stitch, yeah. Like a 3D crochet. Like he's like knitting a jumper and all at once.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we get to talk about actually one of my favorite songs from the show. It's not one of the pastiche songs, but it's Waiting for the Girls Upstairs. This actually has all of the principal actors inside of it. So we have Buddy, Sally, Ben, Phyllis all in this. So I want to give credit where credit's due because we're looking at three different versions of the show. Well, let's do Buddy first. So in the original Broadway cast, it was Gene Nelson. In the 1987 London version, it was David Healy. And in the 2017 version, it was Peter Forbes. Mm. And then so for those three versions of Sally, that's Dorothy Collins, Julia McKenzie, and Imelda Staunton. For Ben, it's John McMartin, Daniel Massey, and Philip Quast. And then Phyllis is Alexis Smith, Diana Rigg, and Janie D. I don't want to go too much further, and I know this is something that you didn't realize before we started recording, but Waiting for the Girls Upstairs, or I think it was maybe just The Girls Upstairs, is what the original title of this show was going to be. Mm. So having only had that information in your head for the previous 5 minutes, what do you think that was a good call to change it to Follies?
I think it's a good call. I think in certainly in terms of people remembering the name, it you know, Follies stands out more. It's sort of a universal recognized term. And you have a good impression of, I feel like, what it's going to be or what the feel of the show is going to be going into it in a lot of senses. The other title is obviously a lot more descriptive and a lot more specific, but I can understand why they wanted to go with that. And I think it's really interesting that we're doing this number because, you know, to me, this is the first bit in the show where we really start to see those conflicts and the real feel of how the evening's going to go on. So I can understand why they went with that. But no, I think Follies was a good choice.
Why I think I like Follies way more is that one, The Girls Upstairs, I think, has this a different connotation of what this show even is going to be about. So I think it's wrong expectations that you're giving to people. But even more than that, why I love Follies is it can mean two things at the same time, which is it's the Follies, like you're going to see the actual like Ziegfeld Follies or the Wiseman Follies in this case. And also, folly has the other connotation of it's people's folly. Like there's multiple people's follies in this, of like causing their downturn. So I love like the little double meaning that you can have with this show.
Mm. And that's interesting to think as well, because the way that follies come up in other Sondheim shows is a theme, like in Sunday when they're going to the follies and her being a folly girl, it's associated with her not having that concentration and everything and playing around. And that's the thing which ends up, you know, being the split between them. So it's interesting to see how that comes up later as well.
You can certainly see what he was influenced by and what he really liked. But it's one of those things too. And I've seen this happen a lot. I'm trying to think of another really great example. I'm not coming up with one, but Sondheim, for instance, like he was influenced by this style, but yet he, except for maybe Follies with his pastiche, I don't feel like really ever leans too far into like this style of music necessarily. Mm. Whereas I've heard like film directors and other people being influenced by certain talents, and yet their stuff never really feels like that. So it's interesting, like what you love versus what you create can be actually two very different things. Mm,
I think, yeah, there's absolutely something in that, because some of the, like he, not in the most, in the kindest way, he's not a massive fan, say, of certain, of some of the composers that he tributes this stuff to, such as Irving Berlin and things like that. But he says, I can appreciate them for what they were, and hence why all of these writings are tributes and love letters to that style, even if he doesn't love it. But it's interesting to see.
Unless it's Noel Coward, who he openly does not like.
That hurts.
All right, well, let's get into it here then. So this song opens up with Buddy specifically, and he calls up the stoop that's usually there on stage. He goes, hey, up there, way up there, what do you say up there? And then spoken, he usually turns to Ben and says, I see it all. It's like a movie in my head that plays and plays. It isn't just the bad things I remember. It's the whole show. Mm. And then he continues singing, waiting around for the girls upstairs after the curtain came down. Money in my pocket to spend. Honey, could you maybe get a friend for my friend?
Hey, up there, way up there. What do you say up there?
I see it all. It's like a movie in my head that plays and plays. It isn't just the bad things I remember. It's the whole show.
Waiting around for the girls upstairs after the curtain came down. Money in my pocket to spend. Honey, could you maybe get a friend for my friend?
So from that opening, anything that you want to call out from just these opening couple lines?
There's a lot going on in it, and it sets it really well. I mean, that opening bit, the hey up there, when he's like, the melody itself is calling up, and it really sets that well. And in the spoken bit, obviously you said it varies from production to production, but in what we've got written there, I love the fact that he says, it isn't just the bad things I remember, it's the whole show. And I love it's such an accurate way of sort of portraying memory, in that, you know, you could sit through something for hours and hours and it could be great, and there could be one thing which ruins the whole experience and ruins the memory, and then you focus on that bad thing for the whole time. And it's great that he opens with that. It's like, it's not just the bad things, it's the great things too, you know, like life is life, there's good and bad. And I love that is, he felt the need to like bring that in.
Well, what I like about that spoken bit, which I'm assuming, I'm like 99% sure that would have been James Goldman who wrote that line.
Mm.
It's a bit of an inversion of what people normally say, right?
Mm.
It's usually you say, it's not just a good time to remember, I remember the good and the bad and stuff like that. And this, he starts with like, it's not just the bad things I remember, which I think is very indicative of Buddy's character, where he always kind of feels like he's down in the dumps a little bit.
Mm. But weirdly, he's also the one that I feel is one of the first to try and look into the good side of a situation.
Yes, 100%, 100%. The other part that I just want to call out here too is the whole idea of like, honey, could you maybe get a friend for my friend? Like the whole concept of this is showing, yes, all of these people in their younger years, but it seems like Buddy and Sally had a relationship already. And so she wanted to go on a double date. So Buddy is the person who is bringing Ben into this group in the first place, and eventually is what causes him to go out with Phyllis, and is eventually what causes Sally to have her breakdown. So I guess what I'm really asking to you, should we be blaming Buddy for everything?
I mean, you do sort of feel this sort of like horrible, and you know, having seen the show all the way through and coming back to it, you sort of think, oh, Buddy, what do you, don't do it, mate.
Don't do it.
but you know, it's like,
get out of the house. Yeah.
If anything though, it's one of those things that is indicative of Buddy's character, that he does seem like this great guy, aside from all the later cheating and things, to what extent you blame him for that, but it's like you can see that he has this good heart and he's like trying to do all these great things, and I think I would argue Buddy's probably, even amongst all of his other stuff, the most likable character, and I think that is really reflected in that line. But you're so right in saying it's sort of, sadly, he's plotting his own downfall by doing that.
Not to belabor the point too much here, but just slightly going back to that spoken bit, for the original Broadway cast, 2017 version, it's what I just read out. But in the London version, the 1987 version, it's actually different, because it's actually Phyllis and Ben having a conversation back and forth.
Ben, wouldn't it be wonderful if we were young again?
Once was enough. Thanks very much.
And I just feel like that is a completely different way to enter into this song versus what normally enters this song. Mm.
It sets a bit of a lower tone in that sense, but it's very, so is it Ben that says that?
Yes. Yeah. It's Ben who says that back.
It's very, you know, given the fact that his character is the one that really just wants to move quickly to, he basically wants to be a big shot. He wants to earn money. He wants to escape a life of not having the money and all of that. He wants the good, glamorous life. So maybe that's the sort of like, he sees this as the period where he doesn't want to look at himself as this sort of, oh, this young person who didn't have much and but all this ambition. But that's also funny, because I guess at certain points in the show, he hates that he had other views of the world as well, and that there is this romantic side as well. So he hates the idea that he's lost something there, I think, as well.
Yeah, the whole idea of the past coming to haunt you. I mean, it's very obvious in this show, what with most versions having like the younger selves and stuff like that on stage and kind of coming in and out and stuff like that. Ben is completely haunted by his past.
Absolutely.
I think more so than most.
Yeah.
What comes next is going to be a longer section I'm going to read here.
Sure.
But Ben continues on, hearing the sound of the girls above, dressing to go on the town. Buddy says, clicking heels on steel and cement. And then Ben and Buddy go, picking up the giggle floating down through the vent. Goddamn, this hours that I ever spent were waiting for the girls upstairs. And then Buddy goes, hey, up there, way up there, what do you say up there? And Ben says, that's where the keys hung, and that's where you picked up your mail. And Buddy goes, like, I remember. Me and Ben, we come around at 10, me and Ben, and hang around the wings, watching things with, what the hell was his name? You know, the old guy? Max, I remember. Anyway, there we'd stay until the curtain fell, and when the curtain fell, then all hell broke. Girls on the run and scenery flying, door slamming left and right. Girls in their undies blushing and trying not to duck out of sight. Girls by the hundreds waving and crying, see you tomorrow night. Girls looking frazzled and girls looking great. Girls in a frenzy to get to a date. Girls like a madhouse and two of them late. And who had to wait and wait and wait. And yeah, and then that's when the girls pick up.
Hearing the sound of the girls above, dressing to go on the town. Clicking heels on steel and cement. Picking up the giggles floating down through the vent. Goddamnedest hours that I ever spent. We're waiting for the girls upstairs. Hey, up there, way up there, what do you say up there? That's where the keys hung, and that's where you picked up your mail.
I remember, me and Ben, we come around at 10. Me and Ben, we'd hang around the wings, watching things with, what the hell was his name? You know, the old guy, Max, I remember. Anyway, there we'd stay until the curtain fell. And when the curtain fell, then all hell broke. Girls on the run and scenery flying, doors slamming left and right.
Girls in their undies blushing but trying not to duck out of sight.
Girls by the hundreds waving and crying, see you tomorrow night. Girls looking frazzled and girls looking great. Girls in a frenzy to get to a date. Girls like a madhouse and two of them late. And who had to wait and wait and wait and wait.
So there's a lot there. I want to dig into some of this. What is the thing that stands out for you the most in that section?
I mean, there's so many great bits, and I think Sondheim's, this is where a lot of the really feel Sondheim comes through as opposed to these other composers, and you yes. start to get the feel. Like the first bit that jumps out to me is the line that Ben says, picking up the giggles floating down through the vent, and it's impossible to say that not in that rhythm, isn't it? Like it's so it's so well written that he's picked these lyrics which just flow so seamlessly into the rhythm that he's intending. And then after that as well, the goddamnest hours, that it has that sort of bounce to it, and I love seeing that little like glimmer of light, little crack of light coming through of Sondheim underneath.
Yeah, there is so many different like kind of weird like melodies that are flowing through that, because you're right, there is like that certain melody line that's going through there. And then you get down to like this somewhat later bit here, and it's very like staccato, like me and Ben, we come around at 10. Like, and we're now getting into like super simple language, right? Yeah. No more goddamnedest, you know, like a giggles floating down. It's just like one syllable words almost through the entire thing. And something that Sondheim will return to actually, even in this show, is this whole idea of like you're singing, but also coming to realizations at the same time. Kind of like how people speak is like, oh, what the hell is his name? Oh, yeah, Max. Mm. Right? Like you're singing that, but you're also acting that at the same time. It's not just like trying to hit a specific note.
That's one of the things he said as well, I think, was that he found there was this sort of complexity and the simplicity of trying to nail down that the colloquial terms and the colloquial speak, how you'd say something. And I think that's where it really starts to come through. And you can tell they're getting excited, aren't they? And the music behind it's reflecting that, the bum, 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 bum. And it's me and Ben and they're it's building up. And I love that's when it's sort of, we start to be drawn back into the past and this exciting world of the Follies and when they were young. And I find it really interesting that right before that, you know, the bit where it goes, that's where the keys hung and da, 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 da. It's like this lovely descending chromatic. It sounds like, do you know, whenever you see a TV show or a film and there's the comic bit with the harp going blah, 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 and then the ripple on the screen. Time. It yeah. feels like that, doesn't it? In my mind, it's like that's where it sort of descends into this dream world and they start to feel it again. I think it's really, yeah, it's an interesting passage that.
Super evocative here, like even when they're talking about like girls on the run and scenery flying, door slamming left and right, like it's impossible not to like envision that in your mind, and yet it's still like rhythmically satisfying. There's still melody going.
Yeah.
It's really cool, for lack of a better word. This is kind of hard to realize unless you actually look at it written out, but Sondheim is actually doing this really interesting internal rhyming over three stanzas because it's like girls on the run, and then later's girls in their undies, right? And then later, girls by the hun, Drid's waving and crying.
Yeah, I can see it now.
So he's run, un, hun, but it's like halfway through the word that he's using that to rhyme with. So I think it goes by so fast, you don't think he'd even realize that that's what he's doing, but he's making that work, which is interesting.
Oh, God, I love that. It's so hidden, isn't it? It's just so damn clever. But I love that. I love that way that, and he's so good at doing, and I think especially in this number, it really shows how great he is at setting those scenes and bringing those memories to life. I mean, earlier in the passage as well, saying clicking heels on steel and cement, like it's very visceral. You can hear it. And that's what some memories are, aren't they? When you really distinctively remember like an element of a memory, and right there at the end, it really brings it to life.
I would even go so far as to say that's what most memory is, right? Like it's either like I remember the sound or the smell or the taste or whatever. It's like and that's how certain flash there, like to this day there is like a certain smell that will remind me of my grandmother's house. Sometimes like this come out of nowhere, I'm like, oh, that reminds me of grandma, and it's just like without warning that can sometimes happen.
Yeah, absolutely, I know what you mean. And then you walk down the street and you smell some like smoky thing and you're like, oh, that reminds me of, where is it? Come on.
Where is it?
And then they start to get those glimmers, don't they, of the memories, and they're trying to piece it together. And it's like a trigger, isn't it? Like one thing triggers another thing in this sequence of memories that come back.
Well, next up are the women who get to have their moment. So here's what the women say. Phyllis goes, waiting around for the boys downstairs, stalling as long as we dare. Which dress from my wardrobe of two? One of them was borrowed and the other was blue. And Sally jumps in, holding our ground for the boys below, fussing around with our hair. Phyllis says, giggling, wriggling out of our tights, chattering and clattering down all of those flights. And then they come together, God, I'd forgotten there ever were nights of waiting for the boys downstairs.
And waiting around for the boys downstairs, stalling as long as we dare. Which dress from my wardrobe of two? One of them was borrowed and the other was blue. Holding our ground for the boys below, fussing around with our hair, giggling, wriggling out of our tights, chattering and clattering down all of those flights. God, I'd forgotten there ever were nights of waiting for the boys.
So what are your feelings about the women's take?
I mean, I love it. It is this great reflection. And, you know, we're being brought upstairs into the dressing room, aren't we? And I love the little connection there, especially the bit at the end of the last phrase with the boys that says, and who had to wait and wait and wait. And it goes on one just a little bit too long. And you can start to, the audience starts to feel their frustration. And then we jump upstairs and they're saying, stalling as long as we dare. You know, it's very much a sort of like, keep them mean, keep them keen.
Yeah. Kind of thing, isn't right. it? No, of you course. Know, yeah, I get it.
They're keeping them on their toes. And I also, I love the line that about the dress saying one of them was borrowed and the other was blue. And it's just such a good line, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think it's just, it makes it's another one of those bits, isn't it? It's like a tangible piece of the old reality that they're bringing back. And they're like, what was it? Oh yeah, one of them was borrowed, one of them was blue. And it's just, it's another one of those really lovely lines that puts you right back into their own memories. It's great.
You know, and I'm not sure if I feel like it's meant to. There's this old, I don't know what you call it, aphorism, I guess, maybe. But anyways, there's a line that usually you say when someone gets married, right? So the bride needs to wear something new, something borrowed, something blue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But I don't know how that really interacts with this scene specifically, because no one's getting married and everything. So I guess probably just to really underscore, like, she doesn't have anything new in her closet. She just has the borrowed and she just has the blue.
There's definitely something in that. I'd be interested to see why he put that in there, because those are two of the elements of the thing, isn't it? Going, oh, I've heard that.
Going back to that, like, visceral, like, sounds and that can evoke a memory. I mean, we're getting the same thing here, like, giggling and wriggling, chattering and clattering. Like, I think those are just super evocative. Like, oh, I get it. Like, I know where you are. I know how this all works together.
Mm. And I love that in the London production, the National Theatre one from 2018, that staircase really does take a very physical or a central presence in the set. And it's, yeah, it all just, it ties together so wonderfully. Mm-hmm. And I just, yeah, I love that idea that the guys are down there, they're up there, and there's just these two different sides to the world where they're like not interacting, and then suddenly they come together, and then that's when all the younger versions of themselves burst into scene. And
yeah, and that's something to really call out, because unless my research told me something completely wrong, my understanding is that the original version of Follies did not have like the younger versions take over singing this song. And neither did the 87 version, as far as I know, but a lot of the newer productions have started doing that. And actually why I love the 2017 version a lot is they really incorporate the ghost characters a lot more into the stage and are basically there the whole time, either in the back or like physically right beside them and mirroring what they're doing. I just think that really underscores the point and the themes of Follies so great. So I like that they take over for this song here.
It's so interesting as well, because I think this was the song that inspired that idea to bring in the younger versions of themselves, because this was written as a quartet originally. Yeah. And then maybe it was James Goldman who said it, and he said to Sondheim, how would it work if it wasn't just a quartet, we made it an octet with their younger selves. So I'm guessing that this was the song that birthed that whole idea.
Yeah.
And although they're only in it for a very brief part of this song, that it's just, it brings the energy, just builds and builds and builds. And it really, you know, it's the moment where all these collective memories that they're having and all these things that we're talking about with these like very visceral, singular moments and parts of their memories come to full fruition, and it snowballs, and suddenly they are their younger selves right there on stage. And it's great.
And I mean, like, who knows until they actually start filming and it gets released. I mean, the director of that 2017 version is supposedly trying to make a film version of Follies, right? Of any of Sondheim's shows, to be brutally honest, I guess besides Sweeney Todd, I find Follies the most cinematic. There's interesting things you could do with like memories and ghosts and going in and out and stuff like that. I think there's some really cool things they could do. Who knows if they'll do that? I don't know, but I feel like this song specifically lends to like, oh, you could do a very cinematic like version of this song, going back and forth, up and down, like back and forth, present, later, past, that sort of thing.
What I love as well is that I think, and it's a sort of sad reality, but I think a lot of the big blockbuster films, in my opinion, are quite checkered, the Sondheim ones. Like, they've got great elements, but they've got elements which really draw them back. And I love that the idea for this one would be, I think, Dominic Cook, I think I'm going to say, is the director, because he slated to do it, and it's sort of in line with this most recent production. I have this idea in my mind that it would be like what they did with the Broadway producers, with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. And the way that film is done is very much like a stage production. So many of the shots feel like it's still on a stage. So I don't know whether it would work better in the fact that maybe the film would be made more like a theatrical production than a big blockbuster story film, because some of the great elements of things like Sweeney Todd get a bit lost when they stray away from these great parts of staging it. So I like the idea.
That's the hard part about adaptation, right? And Sondheim actually writes about that in Finishing the Hat, I think he's pretty honest about most of his film adaptations, of the ones that he likes, elements that he likes, elements he doesn't like. But he's right when he says, I think this was specifically about A Little Night Music, the film version of A Little Night Music, is like, what we do in a song, because it needs to be a song in a stage show, can literally be done in like a 5-second close up in a film. So you have to be really, you have to think of ways to actually make it work visually in a different medium. And sometimes, is that cutting a song, or is that trying to come at it from a different way? So adaptation is always a hard mistress to court, I think.
And I think maybe it would be, not to limit it too much, but maybe it's better and it's more of a duty of a theatre director to be able to think how that would change into screen, rather than a film director trying to adapt something from the stage.
Yes.
Because some of the other ways I feel like it can go quite well. A production that springs to mind was one which was called Richard III, which was done at the Almeida, a place that I work with sometimes. And Rupert Gould, who directed that, did a version for the BBC, and it translated really, really well onto screen because I think he'd done the stage version, and it's interesting to see that.
All right, so we continue on here, and just imagine that it's the guys and girls singing back and forth with one another, because it's basically just one line back and forth. Buddy starts and goes, "You up there, down in a minute. You two up there, just keep your shirts on. Aren't you through up there? Heard you the first time." And then they all sing over top of one another. So here's what the guys are saying. They're saying, "Look, are you coming or aren't you coming? Because look, if we're going, we got to get going. Because look, they won't hold us a table at ringside all night." And then Phyllis and Sally are singing, "Coming, we're coming. Will you hold your horses? We're coming, we're ready. Be there in a jiffy. We're coming, we're coming. All right.
You up there.
Down in a minute.
You two up there.
Just keep your shirts on.
Aren't you two up there?
Heard you the first time.
Look, are you coming or not?
Now, this is one of those Sondheim things, which I mention all the time, which is I am 100% certain you will never know that that is what people are saying the very first time you watch this show.
No, you're 100% right on that, I think.
You get the gist and you understand what's going on 100%, but I don't think anyone would come across as like, this is what the guys are saying, this is what the women are saying, and be able to tell you 100%. But I think still super effective. Anything from here that you notice?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, it's easier to see it written down here. And I love that they're sort of in tandem side by side when it's in the book. But it's you can see that there's this like butting of heads and this clashing. And it's almost like they're in their little tribes, the guys and the girls. It's got that sort of chromatic dreamlike descent again, the melody, isn't it? And it's sort of going, na, 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 na. Yeah. And then suddenly at the end of that, we're back into the memory again, which is what it did before.
Yeah, and this is how it would be even harder, I think, because this is my very untrained ear in music. So maybe take this with a grain of salt. But to me, it sounds like the guys are actually singing at a different tempo than what the girls are, because they're going very slow and methodical through that, where the girls are like rushing through their lyrics. So like that must be hard to do as well, I would think, just to make sure you don't get lost in what like the other people you're singing. You have to be like super focused on what you're saying specifically.
Yeah, no, it's chaotic, isn't it? It almost feels like they're very much having that argument in real time with each other, and they're shouting at each other from upstairs. Yeah, no, it's great.
We are moving into like the young couples and stuff here too. So I'm going to do another kind of longer section here in this case. Yeah. But so Sally says, "Hi." Ben says, "Girls." Phyllis says, "Ben." And Buddy says, "Sally." And then we're going back and forth here between a bunch of them. And so says, "Boy, we're beat. You look neat." That's Buddy saying that. Of course, he would say that. "We saw you in the wings. How are things? Did someone pass you in? Slipped a fin to, what the hell was his name? You know, the doorman? Al? No. Big? Fat? Young? Bald? Harry, yeah. Okie dokes. Come on, folks. And where we're going to go, a little joint I know. What? Great new show there. Hey, I thought you said tonight it'd be Tony's. This joint is just as grand. We girls got dressed for dancing at Tony's. This joint is in demand. Ta-ta, goodbye. You'll find us at Tony's. Wait till you hear the band." And then this time, the girls are saying, "You told us Tony's that we'd go to Tony's. Then Ben mentioned Tony's. Well, someone said Tony's. There's dancing at Tony's. All right, then we'll go." And the boys are saying, "I told you Tony's. I never said Tony's. When's Ben mentioned Tony's? It's ritzy at Tony's. All right, then, we'll go."
"Hi,
girls.
Ben.
Sally.
Boy, we're beat.
You look neat.
We saw you in the wings.
How are things?
Did someone pass you in?
Slipped a fin to, what the hell is his name? You know the doorman.
Al.
Joe.
Big.
Fat.
Young.
Bald.
Harry.
Yeah.
Okie dokes.
Come on, folks.
And where are we gonna go?
A little joint I know.
What?
Great new show there.
Hey, I thought you said tonight it'd be Tony.
And this joint is just as grand.
We girls are dressed for dancing in Tony.
This joint is in demand.
Ta-da, goodbye, you'll find us in Tony.
Wait till you hear the band.
You told us Tony's and
me. I told you Tony's. I never said Tony's.
Well,
Ben means to Tony's. It's dancing at Tony's. All right.
So this whole interchange is great. And I have to say, it has one of the line that never fails to make me laugh, just because it's basically a pun, is the fact of like, bald, Harry? Yeah. Like, so it's like, the guy is bald and his name is Harry. And so I always think that that's so hilarious and funny.
It's great. It stands out. It's one that, that really does. And it, I think it's because it's so, it's the description is so distinctive and blunt. Mm-hmm. And it's hilarious that that is the thing which triggers the memory. It's like, oh yeah, of course. Yeah. It's because it's just such a, no, it's such a straight talking thing to say. And I, it comes as part of that, that whole, this whole big sequence that now that they're kids again, it's like, and it's the memory. It's very, like you said, it's very conversational, back and forth, mm-hmm. back and forth, like conversations are, aren't they? It's very much like, hi, what was it? Oh yeah, you said that, blah, 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 blah. And it's very much, it's, it bounces around a lot more, doesn't it?
It also gets into that thing that I find you find with older couples or couples that have been together for a while, is that this feels like the start to like an argument, like not a knockdown, drag out argument, but just an argument that you have for like years and years and years. Like, remember when you told me we were going to go to Tony's when we first met? It's like, I never said we were going to go to Tony's when we first met. And like, it's just like a restaging of this long-standing argument that people have had.
Yeah, maybe we're starting to see the cracks there for later.
Maybe, just a little
the
bit.
Argument over Tony's. But it's, yeah, no, I love it because it's like, it's back in that rhythm underneath as well, isn't it? Bum, bum, bum. And yeah. It's got that energy and that excitement. And I think what we chatted about before was, it to me it really feels like in Merrily We Roll Along, when in Opening Doors, when they're young, they're fresh, they're new, and they're talking about all these great things they're doing, and it bounces so much between them. You know, thinking about it, this number fits it, I think, more into the category of what Sondheim would call a number rather than a song.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's what he breaks his stuff into. It's like, is it a song or is it a number? And because this one is so conversational and dialogue heavy, it's almost taking the form of replacing a scene of dialogue, isn't it? It's like to cover it all in music. And it's, I love that about it and how conversational it is.
Yeah, this is unlike some of the other songs, even in this show, that have like these like subtexts and like alternate meanings and stuff like that. There's a lot of just pushing the narrative forward, of course. And it's just like a fun scene, like choreography and quartet or an octet, depending on the staging of it. It's fun though, right? That's the thing. I think it's probably same thing when people like me, I'll be the first one to admit, who go potentially like, well, that's a movie and this is a film. You know what I mean? It's like, there's a difference between those two things.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. And I just, it's great that, you know, we're seeing these elements of their personality that are carried through when they're older. And then in the staging, like you were saying, it's in the London one, which is the only staging I've seen, is that they're standing around them and they're watching their younger selves. And I just find that, and sort of laughing and shaking their heads, thinking, weren't we knuckleheads as we get just after this, but it's, or chuckleheads. And it's just, I love it. It's just so, it's a very like entertaining part of the song, especially, and of the show.
So a couple things here, I just want to say, do you have any idea what slip the fin means?
Oh, I was going to ask you. I thought you would know.
I do know. I do know, but I had to look it up. I did not know this.
Is it, I'm going to say $5, $10.
Oh,
like
you
that.
Hit it right on the head. It's a $5 bill specifically.
Ah.
So it's slang for meaning I slipped a guy a $5 bill. Why it's a fin? No idea. But that's why.
It's just one of those things. Yeah. That's one of those things. I think that's like what Sondheim was saying, was trying to nail down these like colloquial terms, especially from what would have been, I guess it's
this would have been 40s. Yeah, probably 40s.
Yeah, 41.
This is kind of like me empathizing with young Sally, because I'm also one of the people who says okie dokes. And she says this that line too. It's like a very down-homey type of way to say, I'm okay. But anyways.
Yeah, I think it's timeless. Yeah. It's timeless, Carl. You're right.
the centerpiece here is like that whole like Tony's argument that they have. There's actually a really great one too. Like, if you've ever listened to, is it called Sondheim on Sondheim? I can't remember. There's like a review done. But there was like Barbara Cook and Vanessa Williams, I think, are like the two duets, and Tom Wopat, and then there's another person that's in there too. But they do a great version of this song too that I actually really like. It's a good version of this song. So, although I'm one of those people who like will listen to anything Barbara Cook sings, so I'm one of those people. But let's do this. This is how we end the song here then. So Buddy goes, waiting around for the girls upstairs, weren't we chuckleheads then? Ben says, very young and very old hat. everybody has to go through stages like that. And then everyone comes together, waiting around for the girls upstairs. Thank you, but never again. Life was fun, but oh so intense. Everything was possible and nothing made sense. Back there when one of the major events was waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls upstairs.
Waiting around for the girls upstairs. Weren't we chuckleheads then? Very young and very old hat. Everybody has to go through stages like that. Waiting around for the girls upstairs. Thank you, but never again. Life was fun, but oh so intense. Everything was possible and nothing made sense. Back there when one of the major events was waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls.
What's your big takeaway from this ending piece?
It's funny how they're all in agreement over this to a certain extent. And I think it's these ideas that they all have of this like shared youth. They all have this like conflicted view, I feel, of their own past, in that they're saying, what was it? One of the bits is everything was possible and nothing made sense. And that's sort of, I guess, them looking back at themselves as being naive and thinking that everything is a massive deal and that there's too much going on and the whole world is ahead of them. But that, you know, it's funny because later in the show, we see that they have very distinctive and different views of their relationships. So it's funny to see that at this point in time, looking back at them at that point, before everything has gone down the toilet, they're all in agreement, aren't they? It's quite, which is quite strange because it's the only time in the show I feel where they're actually in agreement.
No, that's true. I think that's important. We start hearing the agreement and you start to slowly see the cracks start to form throughout the rest of the show. There's a couple things that really speak to me. Honestly, the line that I think is actually the most clever, but so true is like, very young and very old hat. Everybody has to go through stages like that. You know, like I had my own brush with this, but I'm sure everyone else has too. Like you're younger, maybe even in your 20s, early 20s. And it's just like, I'm mature now. So I have to, I'm doing like mature things, right? Because you don't want to be seen as too young. You always have that thing. It's like, I don't want you to see me as a young person. I want to be seen as like someone with that, you know, garner respect and that sort of thing. So whether that's like teenagers, like I read Proust or whatever it happens to be, like it can have a very bunch of, there's different levels of what this can actually turn into for people.
For sure.
I love that line specifically.
I think it's interesting as well, is because it's one of those things that, you would look back on that early part. One would look back on that early part of one's life and think, oh God, you know, it's so ridiculous. But I feel like that's something which you would constantly be revising throughout your life at every past period. You know, you could be in the late stages of your life and think, God, what was I doing in my midlife crisis when I bought that car and that boat? It's everyone wants to look back and sort of, or looks back on their past and always finds that flaw and is just so embarrassed by that time. Because like you're saying, at the time, you're just so self-assured and confident that that's the right way to go. Mm-hmm. But I think it's, obviously that's a theme for the show, but that these kind of people and their characters are much more willing to like, or are much more drawn to being so critical of themselves as opposed to being able to embrace themselves. That I love that line is like, everybody has to go through stages like that. It's almost, it's forgiving to themselves.
Sure.
And these characters generally aren't very forgiving. So it's quite a nice sort of bit to look at.
The other cool thing that I really like is really literally the very, very ending. I just love the harmony that they do, because it's usually the guys who are like waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls, waiting for the girls. Like they do this like little run up to that very final one. It's just so satisfying to me to hear that at the very, very end.
I mean, it's easy to forget when we're analyzing all the lyrics and the meaning and stuff, but the music is just, it is so gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
This whole number has so many elements. And I think this number in particular has elements of a lot of different composers and a lot of different styles. You know, it's got bit elements of Cole Porter. It's got elements of Rodgers and Hammerstein. And it's just it's so rewarding and so satisfying.
Do you have a favorite recording of this song?
They're all quite different. And it's interesting to see the different elements they've got. I mean, for clarity and quality, like the most recent one is great. And you can really hear, I think, sort of the emotions of it, especially. And I absolutely adore Imelda Staunton. I think she acts Sally so well. And even when she's singing, because she's not really that, and I wouldn't say she's that impressive a singer. She didn't start as a singer, but she, you can hear, you know, they are just so, it feels great. But the original London recording as well, I do really like. And I think it's got a bit more sort of oomph at certain points, like the bit where it's me and Ben, and it really starts to kick off. But of course, nothing beats an old Broadway recording. Something, I mean, I shouldn't say it because obviously I work in London theatre, but like there's something about trying to do American theatre outside of America. This is a show which is about New York. And doing it out when it's in New York, I imagine, you know, seeing it on Broadway, a show about Broadway must be a real experience. And I think another show that I saw, it was Angels in America, the Tony Kushner one. Someone who saw it in London at the National Theatre and then saw it on Broadway said that when they saw it on Broadway, it did have that extra added element of sincerity. And I think, because obviously they were all English actors for this, I think, for the Follies one, I would love to see it live on Broadway. Of course, anyone would, but just to see what it's like in the place that it's set.
There's two things I want to bring up about what you just talked about. Very briefly, that Angels in America version, I actually went to a movie theater to see that production being broadcast from the National Theater over two nights, right? Because it's like the part one and then part two, and like emotionally it wrecked me. It was great. It was a great production.
It was brilliant, wasn't it?
It's actually the thing that anytime I hear anyone start to criticize like Nathan Lane, I'm just like, you have not seen Angels in America. You don't have a right to say that he can't.
You haven't seen his Roy Cohn.
But the other thing that you're talking about as far as like Imelda Staunton being like necessarily trained vocally or didn't come from being a singer. This is probably maybe a part of the reason why I do like her so much. And something that someone else verbalized, there was another podcast I was listening to who, I can't remember which one it was now. There's these certain performers that are able, I think, to elevate themselves only because they sound a little bit different, right? So if you go through time, like you have your Ethel Merman's, right? Who's like, you could stand on the stage, belt it out, that Ethel Merman. But you had like Carol Channing. You have Liza Minnelli and Judy Garland, her mother. But then like nowadays you have like, you did have like Bernadette Peters and I'm trying to think of men examples, but I can't. But the idea is like, when you listen to them, it's like, there's something different about their voice, right? There's something to it that's like, it may not be like necessarily like even perfect, but it's like, but it fits what you're trying to do. And I sometimes miss that a little bit when a lot of newer productions, it's not that they have bad singers. They're great singers, but it's like, oh, I want there to be a little bit more like personality to this voice rather than like everyone sounding literally exactly the same. I want there to be something there. And I don't know what that would be called.
I have furious debates with different friends over what they consider to be like a good musical theatre performer. Yeah. And I think it's completely subjective, of course, but people who often train in musical theatre, say are trained in a particular singing style, they're trained to sing with a mic because they'd always expect to be mic'd, for example. Whereas someone who, say, is trained in like a classical singing background, which might not be mic'd, would sing a song in a very different way. And then on the flip side of that, to the acting side, it's like someone who would come from an acting background specifically might do musical theatre and interpret musical theatre in a very different way to someone who was trained specifically in it. And in my mind, I love seeing people who have done things that aren't musical theatre and then coming into musical theatre and bringing something new. I mean, Jake Gyllenhaal doing George, hopefully if it's still on in London, I'll get to see that. And Imelda Staunton is just such a great example because she did film, she did stage, and then suddenly burst onto the scene really doing, in my mind, Sweeney Todd, and then she played Gypsy Rose, and then now she's done this. And she's really starting to build up herself as a cat, like this high caliber, big gun musical theatre performer. And I think that is because she's just got such a unique take on the texts and everything. And that's not to say that hers is the best way, but it's great to see
just different takes,
unique way. Yeah.
That was why for years, like even if they redid Gypsy, it was either you had to like do exactly Ethel Merman or try not to be Ethel Merman. But I just like when people come in and do a completely different take, which is probably why I do like Bernadette Peters' version of Gypsy so much, because it's like, hey, you're doing something completely different. And at least I respect that. That's neat.
Absolutely. And I think that would be like Sondheim's take on it as well, because his thing is that obviously he says the beauty of theatre is that it's endlessly malleable. It's alive. It's like every new production brings something new to that performance. And if it brings something distinct and a new interpretation, like that's why he would love, that's why he goes and sees, I think, so many of his productions again and again. It's because he loves seeing, not because he's vain or anything, but just because he wants to see a new interpretation of it. And if there's something definitive about a new production, then that's really exciting.
Well, thank you so much for discussing this with me, Hugh. If people wanted to like see what you're up to, take a look at your stuff online, how can they do so?
Well, my company's taking a bit of a hiatus. We've swapped some of the social media around, but it might be back on by the time this goes up. And that would probably be under any guise of Junction Theatre Company, like a train junction. Or, you know, find me personally, Hugh Summers. I'm on Twitter and everything. And I talk about theatre sometimes and tweet things about Sondheim always. but I'm not out there in the cloud. You can find me.
Perfect. Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. You can send emails to puttingittogetherpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow Sondheim Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. Thank you to the Alberta Podcast Network, to ATB, to Storylines, and to Pod Power this week. Putting It Together is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and pretty much anywhere you can get podcasts from. Consider subscribing so that you never miss an episode. On our next episode, we'll be discussing the three songs that go back to back to back: Rain on the Roof, Au Paris, and Broadway Baby. I'm hoping that I can get Paddington on for the guest spot. As always, a big thanks to the great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for composing our theme music. Well, we've reached the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.
Life can be bright in America.
If you can fight in America.
Life is all right in America.
If you're all white in America.